that if disaster hit one set, the other was self-sufficient and could complete the mission. Now, Jamie and the others stood waiting for the second half of their expedition to touch down on the dusty surface.
There!
Voznesensky blurted, and they all turned to see a dot in the sky hurtling toward them. Shapeless, formless, it was still too high to be anything more than a dark blur falling across the pink sky like a rock, dragging a bright, flaming contrail behind it like a falling star. My God, Jamie thought, that's what we looked like yesterday. Then a streak of color streamed from the top of the speck and billowed into a trio of broad, white parachutes. The lander slowed, coasted, swaying slightly, gliding toward the ground with the three huge chutes spread above it like angel's wings or the shade awnings of a desert tribe. But it was still falling fast, too fast. Jamie watched for several minutes, his heart in his throat, as the lander floated rapidly downward. It grew and grew into an ungainly-looking combination of saucer and teacup. The circular, arrow-shelled drag brake topped by the cylindrical body of the landing vehicle. Jamie saw that the ceramic underside of the arrow-shell was blackened and streaked from its burning flight through the upper Martian atmosphere. Abruptly, the parachutes separated from the lander and flapped away, lost angels wandering across the Martian landscape. The craft seemed to stagger in midair. Puffs of gray-white steam spurted from its control jets as the lander teetered and righted itself, hovering for an instant. The retro-rockets fired fitful short bursts, blasting grit and swirling dust devils up from the ground as slowly, slowly, the oversized saucer and teacup settled downward, cushioned by the hot rocket exhaust. Through his helmet, Jamie could hear the intermittent screeching of the retros, like the staccato shrill of a frightened bird. The lander was coming down more than 100 meters away, yet a miniature sandstorm was pelting against his hard suit. He resisted the earth-trained impulse to lean into the wind. There was no real pressure pushing against him in this thin atmosphere. Finally, the noise ceased, the sand stopped blowing, and the segments of the aeroshell drooped to the ground like wilted petals of a huge metal flower. Jamie heard in his earphones,
"That's it! We're down!"
There had been surprisingly little argument over the language to be used on Mars. For more than half a century, scientists had used English as their common worldwide tongue, as had aircraft pilots and their ground controllers. A few of the politicians had put up something of a struggle, more for their own national egos than for any serious reason. The French had been especially difficult. Yet, in the end, they had to face the fact that the one language all of their prospective explorers understood was English. Still, Voznesensky spoke in Russian through his suit radio to the pilot of the second lander, Alexander Mironov, while Ilona Malater and Tony Reed set up the hand-sized video cameras on their tripods. Ioana Grumado, in her day-glow orange hard suit, turned toward Jamie.
"I suppose we are just the spear carriers."
"Waterman!"
Voznesensky's voice rang in Jamie's earphones.
"Take the steel camera and photograph the aerobrake structure."
Jamie said to Ioana.
"One spear carrier." "Grumado!"
the Russian called.
"Monitor the gas emissions from the landing craft."
He heard the Brazilian woman's laughter.
"No spear carriers."
After slightly more than a quarter hour, the hatch of the landing vehicle popped open, and the slim metal ladder slid down to the red dust. A figure encased in a brilliant red pressure suit appeared at the hatch. Must be the other Russian, Jamie thought, as he snapped photos for the expedition's official history. Six hard-suited figures trooped slowly down the ladder, one after the other, and gathered in front of the video cameras with their lander behind them. They, too, spoke solemn words about the triumph of the human quest and the glories of human intelligence and drive. Jamie knew the six to be a Russian, an American, a Japanese meteorologist, a fellow geologist from India, an Egyptian geophysicist, and a French geochemist who was the only woman among the second landing team. The politicians had worked frantically to please as many nations as possible and to get as many as possible to help fund the $250 billion Mars project. To their credit, where it was necessary for them to balance national pride against scientific needs, national pride did not win every round. But if an Israeli biochemist was selected to go to Mars, then it became absolutely necessary to send a follower of Islam along. It was imperative that both Japan and France be represented, and of course, there must be the same number of Russians and Americans. Jamie's last-minute substitution for Father DiNardo had upset the Soviet-American balance, and while that could not be helped, it was not accepted gladly either in Moscow or, strangely, in Washington. The first team started to help the second team unload their landing ascent vehicle. More equipment would be sent later in the day by automated, unmanned, one-way landers from the spacecraft in orbit. Voznesensky was in charge of all the ground team, with Pete Connors his ostensible second in command. But Jamie heard a lot of Russian chatter in his earphones. The two cosmonauts were already talking to each other to the exclusion of the others. Jamie was surprised then when Voznesensky tapped him on the shoulder of his hard suit.
"Come to the communication center,"
the Russian said.
"The expedition commander wishes to speak to you."
Without a word, Jamie hefted the crate of chemical analysis equipment he was already carrying and followed Voznesensky into the airlock. After it cycled and they had vacuumed the red dust off their boots, they stepped inside the dome. Jamie put the equipment crate down just inside the hatch and unconsciously slid his helmet visor up as he walked alongside the Russian to the comm console. His ears popped again. The air inside the dome was an Earth-normal mix of oxygen and nitrogen, pumped up to normal terrestrial pressure and heated to a comfortable temperature. The hard suits operated at almost normal terrestrial atmospheric pressure. Almost, but not quite. The transition from suit to regular air made itself felt in Jamie's inner ear. It was one of those minor maladies that no Mars explorer would even whisper about during training for fear of being scratched from the team. Here on Mars, though, it was already annoying, and this was only the second day. Dr. Li Chengdu, the expedition commander, was exceedingly angry with Jamie Waterman. The only visible sign of his anger was the slight throbbing of a vein in his forehead above the left eye. Otherwise, his face was a mask of calm. The olive-drab coveralls he wore were not quite standard issue. Dr. Li affected a stiff collar instead of the open-necked style everyone else wore. In the back of his mind, Jamie wondered if that was supposed to be symbolic. Puzzled, Jamie sat at the comm desk in front of the main display screen. The six other screens flanking it showed views of the unloading chores going on outside. Voznesensky stood behind Jamie like a policeman guarding a prisoner about to be interrogated. "Dr. Li," said Jamie, still in his blue suit and helmet.
"Dr. Waterman?"
"You wanted to speak to me?" Li took in a silent breath, nostrils flaring as if in distaste.
"I have just received a most unhappy transmission from Kaliningrad, which was relayed from Houston."
Jamie tried to keep his face as stiffly unemotional as the expedition commander's.
"Your American mission controllers are quite upset that you did not speak the words they gave you for your first statement from the surface of Mars."
"Yes, I suppose they are. Of course they'd be upset. The Anglos in Washington always get upset when a red man doesn't follow their script."
"Why did you say what you did? And what does it mean? Apparently, it has caused a sensation in the media in the United States."
With a slight shake of his head, Jamie replied, "I had no intention of causing a sensation. I didn't know I was going to say that until I heard myself speaking. The words, they simply popped out of my mouth."
"What do they mean?"
"It's an old Navajo greeting, like Aloha among the Hawaiians, or the Italians ciao. Literally, it means something like, it is good." Lee's stiff shoulders relaxed visibly. The throbbing vein eased.
"Your government people are very angry with you,"
Jamie tried to shrug inside the hard suit